This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Hey, this is Jason Hartman. Thank you so much for joining me. Do you know what day it is? Yes, it is Flashback Friday, where you hear the best of the Creating Wealth show, and you hear some good prior episodes, some good review. Remember, we've got almost 500 episodes out, and you know what? iTunes doesn't even hold them all if you're an iTunes listener. If you are listening on Stitcher, thank you for joining us. So we want to bring you some good review stuff. Now, what's interesting about Flashback Friday, it's a little scary for me. I gotta be very, very candid with you on that, because you, the listener, you get the chance to hold my feet to the fire. Did I make any predictions? Was I right? Was I wrong? I've been right about a lot of things, but I've been wrong about a few. But it's Flashback Friday, and we will give you the uncensored best of the Creating Wealth show with a prior episode. So let's dive in. Here we go. Remember, this is not current. It's Flashback Friday.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
This is your host, Jason Hartman. Thanks so much for joining me today. Well, thank you so much for all of you who have registered to join us for our Creating Wealth Bootcamp in Atlanta, along with our Atlanta Distressed Property Tour. We're getting lots and lots of registrations for that, and we usually get one or two every day, so it's just plugging along nicely, and I'm glad to see a lot of you taking advantage of the early bird discount, so that's fantastic. So on this show today, we're going to have a caller from Australia. And we are also going to talk about the quants and dark pools. And what that is all about is high-frequency trading and all of the stuff that goes on Wall Street that continues to amaze me. And I hope it continues to amaze you as well, because it really is incredible. And I think you'll find this guest today to be very, very insightful. So we'll have that in just a moment. But on the last episode, on episode number 271, you know, I talked to you a little bit about organizing your income property portfolio. And I promised, after talking about the acquisition file, that legal size file, now we're talking about good old paper files here. But we also, of course, use software in our real estate investing business. But we're just talking about good old-fashioned paper files here. And today I'd like to just talk to you for a moment about the operations file. Now, the operations file is the file you'll use often. So you want to keep this in a physical drawer somewhat near you. Of course, you can scan it and you can use it within the property tracker software, which I highly recommend. Or, you know, some people just like a good old physical file, and I gotta say, I consider myself to be fairly techy, but for some things, I just like good old-fashioned paper. It tends to work well that way. So with this physical file, and this is your operations folder, this is the one that is letter size, so 8.5 by 11, and it is a classification folder, so it's got 6 tabs to it. And the way you organize those tabs, very simple, and this is a continuation again of last episode where I talked about the other file that goes with it, and that is the acquisitions file. So in this one, tab 1, you'll have your HUD 1 closing statement, a description of the property, of any photos of the property, copies of maybe a plot plan of the property, and a change of address receipt from the U.S. Postal Service. Now, I always recommend that you do those change of addresses for your properties, because if statements get sent to the properties, and of course you don't occupy the properties, right? You live somewhere else because you're following my advice to invest in properties that make sense. so you can afford to live in a property that doesn't make any sense. In other words, a nice high-end property for yourself, but lots of bread and butter properties that you rent to other people, whether they be single-family homes or apartment buildings or fourplexes or whatever.
Remember, you're listening to Flashback Friday. Our new episodes are published every Monday and Wednesday.
So you do that change of address so that mail is forwarded to your either P.O. box or the place where you live so you get the mail for that property. Tab number 2, mortgage statements on the first loan on the property. Tab number 3 is your warranty on the property and any property tax information. Tab number 4, mortgage statements for the second loan on the property or your insurance information, homeowners association statements if you have a homeowners association, and utility bills. And then tab number 5 is your monthly property manager statements that you get from your property manager, or if you're self-managing your property, any records you use to keep track of that. And tab number 6 are your contracts with your property manager, if you have one, and your tenant leases, and maybe the tenant application as well. So there you go. There you have it, your operations folder, the one you'll reference probably at least once a month, and that acquisitions folder is sitting in a bottom drawer. You know, those gold bugs, they're always bugging me, those gold bugs, and I don't know why, I just have a thing for them. I guess they just bug me because they are so illogical. And the lack of logic in the gold bug world never, ever ceases to amaze me. And I want to remind you that Peter Schiff, I'm a fan of Peter Schiff, but you know, I also want to hold him accountable to something. Peter Schiff said, by the end of Obama's first term, gold would be $5,000 an ounce. And better hurry up, Peter, because we're not even close to $5,000. Gold has got to triple, well, it's got to more than triple to be at $5,000 an ounce. And every gold bug you talk to, if you ask them the question, is the price of gold going up or the value of the currency, in this case the dollar, is it going down? They will unanimously say, and this is a trick question, by the way, on my part, they will unanimously say that it's the dollar that's going down. In other words, the metal, the silver, the gold, whatever the commodity is for that matter, but usually silver and gold we're talking about, that is simply keeping pace with inflation. They will say that to you every single time. So I ask you this. Now, I don't think Peter Schiff's going to be right, but even if he is, if gold goes up to $5,000 by November, the end of Obama's first term, and I hope the end of Obama's presidency in general, but if it goes to $5,000, what will happen to the value of your debt on your income properties? Let's see. Gold, let's just say gold triples in price. That means the destruction of your debt, if the gold bug argument is correct, and I actually believe it is, it's not gold that's going up, it's the dollar that's going down. That means your debt will be decimated by 2/3. That means you'll have a huge 66% reduction in your debt. Wow, amazing. If you owe $1 million against your income property, you will, after gold triples in price, not in value, just in price, in nominal dollars, not real dollars, because there hasn't been any real gain. That's what the gold bugs will tell you, right? After it triples, your debt will decline massively, okay? So you will owe far less than what it says you owe in real dollars. In nominal dollars, of course, it'll still say the same thing. And I just got to point that out. I want to remind you, let's see if Peter Schiff is right. See if by November, gold is $5,000 an ounce. I don't think it's going to happen. But if it does, our debt is going to be dramatically reduced against our income properties. And the value of the commodities attached to that debt will have kept pace, just like the gold, with inflation with the devaluation of the dollar. So that's that. Okay, hey, let's take a caller from Australia. And thank you so much for calling into the show. By the way, be sure to do this. And I want to just tell you, I know some of you are kind of shy out there and you may not want to call into the show, but remember, it's edited in post-production. So if you say anything silly or, you know, you got too many ums and ahs in there, our editor will fix that up for you, okay? So it's not like calling into a live radio show. That's one of the other beauties of it. I hope that takes away a little bit of your reluctance to call into the show. It's easy. Do it. Call into the show. We want to have you calling in and asking questions and participating and contributing to the show. So please be sure to do that. Anyway, let's take a caller here, and I'll be back with you for just a moment before our guest. Hey, it's my pleasure to welcome Stefan to the show. He's calling from Australia. How are you, Stefan?
Yeah, hi, Jason. Good. I thought I would just take you up on your opportunity to call in on Skype.
Well, and
have a question for you.
And thank you so much for calling. We'd love to get a lot more calls. I haven't really pushed that yet, but you're one of the early few callers. So how are you doing?
Okay, yeah, I'm good. I'm calling you from the Sunshine Coast in Australia, and I listen to your podcast and find them very helpful. I had a question. You had a guest on a little while ago, and he was talking, I think he was one of your investor clients, who was talking about being in an advantageous position if the banks do go into hyperinflation by owning multiple rental income earning properties. And yeah, not being too financially intelligent, I wasn't really clear as to why it is advantageous to own multiple rental income properties if we go into a state of hyperinflation, and was seeking some clarification on that.
Yeah, actually, great question. Well, there are two main reasons, and really there are three. So the first thing I would say is, what are the options out there? Most people would say in an inflationary environment, you know, you want to own gold or precious metals. And
right.
I think, and you know, like you've heard me say on many episodes, I think those are okay. I think they're just okay. They're better than dollars or any currency out there, but they're not better than income property. And the reason for income property that it performs so well in an inflationary environment is really twofold. One is, of course, just like gold and silver, any commodity generally does very well as a hedge against inflation. So whether it be soybeans, coffee beans, lumber, petroleum products, gold, silver, any form of commodity item does pretty well. It usually keeps pace and hedges inflation pretty well. Okay, so that's the first part. So of course, when you own these income properties, you own a lot of commodities. I always talk about packaged commodities investing or assembled commodities investing. You've got concrete, lumber, labor, petroleum products, glass, steel, all the ingredients for a house. So, you know, we all would agree on that, the commodities, that's the first part. But the part that really, really, really makes it special is what I call inflation-induced debt destruction, where when you have inflation basically pays your debts for you. So, for example, if you borrow $1 million and you buy real estate with it, and let's assume it doesn't produce any income, it's not even as good as income property, it's just a property. Say, for example, you live in it, or it's a property you just keep vacant. And if you got a $1 million interest-only loan on these properties, then in 1 year, if there's just 10% inflation, the value of that dollar, of that money you owe, declines, just like the value of the money you have declines. So the money in your savings account would go down by 10% if there's 10% inflation, because it would have 10% less purchasing power. But also the value of the debt you owe against the properties would decline as well, because that is also being destroyed by inflation, just like our savings, our stocks, our bonds, our equity and real estate. That's inflation-induced debt destruction. So we like it when our debt gets destroyed.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Flashback Friday. Our new episodes are published every Monday and every Wednesday.
But doesn't that mean, like, you've got tenants that are paying rent on your property, and they're in effect paying the devalued mortgage, but the amount that the tenants can afford and what they're actually paying is also devalued as well?
Well, the amount of their rent, if you say, for example, you have a one-year lease on the property. Now, you know, if we had hyperinflation within that year, that would hurt you because you could probably charge more if you were to kick that tenant out or they were to move and you were to lease it to a new tenant, because rents are indexed to inflation very well. In fact, historically speaking, at least in the States, rents typically outperform inflation. But remember, here's the thing. Okay, the mortgage payment doesn't go up, and the cost of running the property really don't go up, except maybe very nominally, but the mortgage certainly won't because it's a 30-year fixed loan. Even if you could get a higher rent from somebody else, in relation to the property, if you can't raise the rent for you have to wait a whole year to raise the rent, for example, so what? That's not really going to hurt you that much because it's tied to the property's functioning. And so that's not going to hurt you too bad. Now here's another question that you may be thinking of because you almost alluded to it in the last question. When you talk about how we've always got to think about our tenants and how inflation affects them, not just how it affects us, because we're not investing in a vacuum, right? We're subject to market forces too. If our tenants have problems, we have problems potentially, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, so let's look at how inflation will affect them. They may get a raise that is tied to, say, the cost of living, but that always understates inflation. So what you'll see there is the tenant will suffer. Okay, and say, for example, that one-year lease comes up and you raise the rent, and you raise it a lot because there's been a lot of inflation in that year. So rents are skyrocketing with everything else, with the cost of gas and coffee and food at the supermarket, and everything is going up, right? But the question is, because that's a pretty grim scenario, it's a pretty gloomy scenario if everybody's hurt by inflation. Well, so what I say will happen is the standard of living will just decline. That's where the pain will be felt. So maybe now that tenant rents a nice 4-bedroom, 2.5 or 3-bath house from you, and say that house is 2,000 square feet. Well, if inflation comes along, they might have to move out of that house and move into an 1,100 square foot home. With, you know, with 3 little tiny bedrooms and just 1.5 baths. So their standard of living will decline, but there will still be a renter. That's the person that moved down from the 3,000 square foot house that moved into your 2,000 square foot house. So, you know, it's just a ladder. They're always moving up and down the ladder. And I think it is a gloomy scenario for most people except us, because we know how to beat the inflation.
So is there any implication of the hyperinflation of the banks then adjusting sort of what the value of currency becomes? Because let's say you have a 30-year mortgage on a property, and let's say you owe the bank $200,000, and then the value of the currency decreases, but the amount that you owe the bank is still 200,000, isn't it? The bank can't say, well, now 200,000 is not worth 200,000. You actually owe us 800,000.
Right. Well, you know, I suppose they could pass some kind of law and basically revalue all the money out there, but that would be extremely difficult to do. The fact is, no, under current law, they can't do that. I mean, the bank cannot rewrite your loan. And think about it. The inflation game only benefits the government and the central banks like the Federal Reserve and other central banks around the world. They actually benefit from it because all of the money they owe. See, the government is quite familiar with inflation-induced debt destruction, okay, even though they don't use that term. But, you know, if we owe China $1 trillion worth of our bonds and treasury bills and we have 10% inflation, well, then we owe them 10% less the next year, right? So it's a great deal for the government. Right. So the government wouldn't want to revalue. They wouldn't want every bank to revalue their loan because that would dramatically hurt the economy. They'd rather let the banks suffer and let the government benefit. That's extremely unlikely. But hey, when you control the laws and the military, you can do anything you want, you know?
Yeah, right.
So I can never say never, but I can't imagine it happening. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So your strategy is to get into as much debt as you possibly can and have the rental income cover the mortgages and then wait for the hyperinflation to pay the loans off, in effect.
Yeah, you know, that's not the only strategy, but it's definitely a major part of it. I mean, I don't want to say debt in general. Of course, I want to say only long-term fixed-rate debt tied to income properties that produce income, that pay for themselves, where you have the opportunity to outsource the debt to a tenant, where the tenant becomes responsible for the debt. And that's not consumer debt. It's good debt. It's not bad debt.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I understand. Oh, that's helpful.
Now, a good question to ask, Stefan, is say it doesn't happen. Say that hyperinflation never comes. Say somehow we defy the laws of gravity and physics through this whole explosion of money printing. You know, just under Obama, we've had another $5 trillion of money created out of thin air that didn't exist 3.5 years ago. I mean, that's an incredible thought, $5 trillion, right? And so if that doesn't happen, and if we just sort of plod along the way we did in the 80s and the 90s and the first decade of the 2000s, I mean, heck, it's still going to be great. It's going to be as great as it was for all of the millions of people who owned income property through the last three decades. But if we get that
provided, you can have the tenants covering the mortgage on that.
Oh, absolutely. And every property we have nowadays is positive cash flow from day one.
Mm. Okay. So we're not really having those sort of properties in Australia at the moment because we haven't really sort of bottomed out. Most of our properties are still a fair way off from being positively geared at the outset. We're still paying sort of 6 and 7% interest rate on the mortgages and the tenants. The rental income from the tenants is probably only about half of what the mortgage repayments are.
Oh, yeah.
And that's negotiated maybe a 10% reduction on the price because the market is slow, but it hasn't, you know, there's a lot of optimism and a lot of hope with the mining industries and the resources boom in Australia that we're going through. And so people are sort of thinking, we're not going to see, you know, Detroit and Miami sort of price falls over here.
Yeah.
Yeah, you there?
Yeah, I am. The connection.
You there, Jason?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yeah.
Okay. The connection got bad there for a moment. So, yeah, I think that is definitely not going to work because whenever you have a situation where your mortgage cannot be covered by the rent and your other expenses can't be covered by the rent, you know that's a great sign that you're in a bubble, that things have to adjust. And there's only two ways they can adjust. Either the rents have to go up radically or the prices have to go down radically or the interest rates have to go down radically. In other words, the cost of owning that property has to go down.
Right, exactly.
Probably it's not going to be a matter of interest rates. What are your mortgages like there nowadays?
Yeah, they're about 25 to 30 years at about 7%. So it's very high, you know, very high.
Well, historically it's not that high, but yeah, it's high. It's high compared to the U.S. See, the U.S. is just defying gravity with the way its Federal Reserve system works.
Right.
It's a scam. It's a sort of a Ponzi scheme. It's not exactly a Ponzi scheme the way that's played out. But the point is, benefit from that. I mean, use that to your advantage.
Yeah. No, that's very helpful. Thanks, Jason. I was wondering that because I was listening to you talking to one of your clients and they were sort of going on about how they want to get lock in as many loans as possible with the tenants paying the mortgage. And I thought, if we're going to hyperinflation, isn't that bad? But you've explained that, so it's helpful.
Good.
Yeah,
well, hey, just before you go, do you mind sharing your investing experience with the listeners? Are you new to investing or experienced?
Yeah, I'm fairly new. I'm 40 years old and I've done a couple of little places, one in Sydney, a little subdivision, and one in the Sunshine Coast, two actually on the Sunshine Coast and then my own place. And the most sort of effective one that I've found is a place that I renovated the downstairs area to add four bedrooms. So this is a house sort of in the middle of a town area where it's great walking distance to the beaches and the shops and everything. And I bought a two-story brick place that was old and run down, renovated upstairs, added four bedrooms downstairs. So I've now got eight unrelated people renting individual rooms from me. And I cover the utilities and I provide a wireless internet facility through the house. And that seems to work very well. That property is actually positively geared. But that was an interesting lesson, because when I bought it, what I could have rented it out for would have been substantially negatively geared. But by spending another $100,000 on the renovation and adding the extra rooms and then getting the four additional rental incomes in, it bumped it up. So I spent a little bit more, but the returns were a lot more. Yeah, if that makes sense.
Right.
So that property is sitting there, and it's in a fantastic location, and I'm sure it'll get some capital growth sooner or later. But I'm, like a lot of people, I'm not sure what's happening with the economy and whether things are actually going to go up or just plateau out for 10 years or so. But in either case, it's just ticking along, paying for itself. It's not going ahead, but it's not going backwards.
What got you interested in U.S. investing, and how long have you been listening to my podcast?
I've been listening to you for about 3 months, and I did live in the States for a while, probably 10 years ago. I won a green card in the Visa lottery pop-up internet ads. They just, when you're online, these ads pop up and they say, you know, the American government is giving away a certain amount of green cards. So I applied for that years ago, and I actually won a green card. So I went over to the States and enjoyed it. And I particularly like Miami and sort of been interested in the property there and reading some forums on Miami investing. And in time to come, I think I'll probably look at buying a property over in Miami somewhere. And
let me just tell you, it's too early for Miami. I just think it's too early still. We have people asking us about Miami many times a week. and the other one they always seem to ask about is Las Vegas, of course.
Yeah.
Those two. And it's just too early. Yeah, just wait. Miami's one of those high flyer markets.
Latin Americans.
I know.
Yeah, it seems that all the Latin Americans have just moved into Miami, and they're spending all their equity that they, you know, Venezuelans and Brazilians and stuff. But once they hit problems, then I think it will really slump. Yeah. So I'm sort of holding out a little bit.
Yeah, I would be very careful of areas like Miami, and if you're in them, don't do condos. Just do good old fashioned single family homes, because once you add that condo complex and that homeowners association to the mix, it just has so many new problems that are created that weren't there
even
before.
In university districts, because I hear that you can get a condo apartment for $40,000 or $30,000, and it'll, you've got good rental income from university students and low homeowners fees.
Right, right. Well, we're generally against condos. A few times we'll make an exception. We did make an exception in Dallas, where we've got these really inexpensive condos that you can almost treat like apartment buildings, where you could buy several of them right next to each other. And you know, those are kind of interesting. They're especially interesting, by the way, for foreign nationals, because they're very inexpensive and they have really good cash flow. But a lot of the Miami condos, I see investors buying them all the time, and I just think, gosh, what are they doing? I wish I could stop them and knock some sense into them.
Yeah.
You know, where they're expensive, really nice condos, and it just doesn't work. It's just so risky. I mean, thousands of people have been burned from things like that. So
I would
really, really be careful.
You know, what are your thoughts on the single family homes sort of on Miami Beach up in the North, Biscayne and Surfside? You can pick them up for sort of low 200s.
I think they're too expensive. Look, my general philosophy is it's the opposite of everything I like. Okay, I like sexy and swanky and cool. I live in a gorgeous penthouse myself. But to invest in, I like milk and cookies, meat and potatoes, whatever you want to call it.
The middle of the bell curve.
Just really simple suburban single-family homes. That has always just been a really nice, stable type of deal. So
I agree. When you're targeting the bell curve of the population, you're more likely to hit the nail on the head than if you go for the extremes, either too high or too low.
No question. So today, now this is a moving target, but today that number means a property that's, say, $130,000, somewhere around there, not above. It might be $90,000 to $130,000. And of course, that price is going up a bit. So, you know, you talk to me in 6 months, it might be $110,000 to $150,000. But the nice thing about that section on the bell curve is that you can catch the people moving up and you can catch the people moving down. And I say, if we have this hyperinflation, there's going to be a lot of people moving down. And those are still respectable enough houses that people can live a happy life in them and also batten down the hatches during an inflationary environment or a bad economy of any kind. There are other types of bad economies that aren't inflationary. You know, it can just be depressionary in general or deflationary, depression or recession. But I just think that's a really good stable bet.
Okay? Yeah, and, me too.
And the other thing I would say is spread them around geographically. Have a couple in this city, a couple in that city, a couple in another city, you know, just in case. Hedge your bets that way as well. Okay.
Yeah, I like the city investing because you've got the, and you always will have the concentration of the population in the larger areas, and if you need to turn it over or if you need to get more tenants, you know, you want to be in an area where you've got a lot of employment for people and that sort of thing. You know, I'm in a regional area, but it's, I mean, we're 320,000 people here on the coast, but it's a high tourist area, probably sort of similar to Fort Lauderdale or somewhere like that.
Well, like I mentioned, I've been to Noosa and Surfers Paradise in Australia and Sydney as well. And I love Noosa. I thought that was a great, great little town.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And you're right near there. You're about a half hour away from Noosa, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, I'll probably 45 minutes. If you're down here again, yeah, let me know. I'd love to catch up.
I'll definitely look you up.
All right.
Thanks so much for calling into the show. It's like 10 minutes after 11 p.m. here, but I just happened to catch your call, and I always love talking to investors.
I got to get back to work.
Especially from down under. What time is it there?
It's 4:15 in the afternoon.
All right. Well, you get back to work, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks for calling in.
Okay. Thanks, Jason.
So another great call. Please be sure to call into the show. We'd love to have you participate. Now, let's go to our guest in just a moment here, but I just want to remind you, if you haven't registered already for our Atlanta Creating Wealth Bootcamp and Property Tour, be sure to do that as soon as possible at jasonhartman.com/events. All right, we will be back with our guest today in just a moment.
You know, sometimes I think of Jason Hartman as a walking encyclopedia on the subject of creating wealth.
Well, you're probably not far off from the truth, Penny, because Jason actually has a 3-book set on creating wealth that comes with 60 digital download audios.
Yes, Jason has that unique ability to make you understand investing the way it should be. It's a world where anything less than 26% annual return is disappointing.
I love how he actually shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I also like how he teaches you to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
And the entire set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered at a savings of $94.
That's right. And to get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series, complete with over 60 hours of audio and 3 books, just go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month, just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you.
My pleasure to welcome Scott Patterson to the show. He is a writer for the Wall Street Journal. He is the author of a few different books, including The Quants and Dark Pools. And we're going to talk about how this affects Wall Street and high-speed trading and all of the stuff related to those things. Scott, welcome. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks a lot for having me.
My pleasure. Are you located in New York, by the way, today?
No, I'm actually in Washington, D.C. I used to work out of New York for the Journal, but now I cover financial regulation for the Journal, and this is where all the regulators are. So
being close to the government is helpful, right?
Yeah. Just down the street here.
Well, your latest book is Dark Pools, right?
Right.
Start with that one and tell us about it.
Right. So, this book is about the shift to automated trading and computer-driven trading on Wall Street that's really exploded on the scene in the past 10 years or so. When I was in New York working at the Wall Street Journal a couple years ago after I'd written The Quants, we started hearing more and more about this trading style called high-frequency trading. And I wrote a piece that said that it was estimated to account for about 70% of all the volume on the markets. And that was just sort of a jaw-dropping number for all of us at the paper who cover this stuff. So I dive more and more into it and basically learn a whole lot about the industry.
And in other words, 70% of the trading on Wall Street, 70% of the market is controlled by computers then?
It's probably more like 95% is controlled by computers.
Oh, even worse. Wow.
But 70% is specifically high-frequency trading. So most of the trading that goes on today is driven by computers. If you're invested in a mutual fund, your fund manager is using computers to implement those orders into the market. But he's often interacting with a high-frequency trader.
And, it just begs the question, can the little guy, the middle-class investor, just the regular everyday investor out there, can they beat the system? I mean, so many people are kind of sold on the idea that they can somehow match the computers, the algorithms, the quants. It's really part of the same equation because the quants make the algorithms that run the computers, right?
Right,
and,
yeah.
And,
definitely.
Is it even possible for the little guy to compete with this?
In a word, no. after seeing how sophisticated these firms are, they hire PhD physicists and, electrical engineers and, people from the top universities in the country, MIT and University of Chicago, to design these systems. And, just day trading is just a bad idea now. It's just not, it takes so much firepower, so much speed. And I think that's not really the problem that I'm concerned about, though. I mean, if people want to try their, luck on playing the market, that's their decision. But what I'm really worried about is that even the trade execution experts for the mutual funds are getting outgunned by these HFT firms, which are, there's really just a few of them that are very, very good. And from what I can tell, they're constantly winning the race on the exchanges. And, you could say in a way that's a tax on the individual investor who's investing in 401ks and mutual funds.
You said HFT firms. What does that mean? HFT.
Right. That's short for high frequency trading.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Right. Yeah. Okay. So it's not just that high frequency trading is something that firms on Wall Street do. There are firms that call themselves HFT firms. That's an actual category of business. This is what do you do? Well, I have a high frequency trading business.
These are private companies, largely the best ones. It's kind of like a family office. They're run by just a few owners, and they employ teams and teams of quants and computer programmers, and they're just wildly successful. One of the biggest is called Getco. It's based out of Chicago. That's short for a global electronic trading company, I believe, and they're just wildly successful. Getco accounts for something in the order of 20% of the volume of some of the biggest stocks in the United States. And that's just one firm.
Unbelievable. So where do they get their money to invest with? Are these just wealthy families that set up an HFT firm?
Well,
they
started off really small. And, this is one of the stories I tell in my book, Dark Pools, is, how they rose up in the late 90s and early 2000s. Very small firms trading on these new electronic communication networks that were trying to compete with the big stock exchanges like the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ. These are completely computer-driven networks. The high-frequency firms started using them because they could handle the automated trading that they were very good at. But they were very small. They didn't have a lot of money. But over the decade, they got bigger and bigger and bigger. And as the market shifted towards automated trading and you know, the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ incorporated those computer-driven trading networks, they came to dominate the market and explode in profitability. So it's really only been, you know, the past 5 years or so that they've gotten to be as big as they are and as dominant as they are.
So then high frequency trading definitely works, right?
Oh yes, it's very effective. It's a brilliant strategy. You know, they basically flood the market with buy and sell orders and only trade when their systems predict that they'll be profitable, or at least that's what they try to do. So they cancel most of their orders. So they'll put in tons of buy and sell orders, but they'll cancel something to the order of 99% of those orders and only trade when they really want to.
So they're just really clogging up the system too, right? I mean, they're keeping people from getting their orders executed. Other people can't get their orders executed because they're just flooding the system with noise, it sounds like.
Well, that's a big concern now, is that the amount of data that the exchanges and other trading networks are forced to handle because of this is just clogging up the system and could lead to even, you know, some outages. And another problem is that they're able to jump in front of other firms. That's part of the strategy, is they can see, you know, they have direct links to all these different venues across the market, and they can see how the market is moving by, you know, detecting, like, you know, when a stock moves on the New York Stock Exchange, when is that going to also move on a dark pool, say. So they're able to constantly jump in front of other firms in the order book and be at the front. And that's really essential to their strategy, is being in the front and getting the order when it happens.
So explain to the listeners, what is a dark pool? I mean, that's the title of your book. What is a dark pool?
Right. Yeah, so the technical term for a dark pool is a sort of a private, secretive trading venue where stocks are bought and sold away from the public markets. The buy and sell orders are not made public. The order only is made public after there's an execution. So the supply and demand that's in the dark pool is invisible. But the larger argument that I'm making in this book is that the entire market is shifting towards darkness, a lack of transparency. Even the public markets, like the New York Stock Exchange, is becoming increasingly opaque. And we just saw yesterday that the SEC approved the New York Stock Exchange's proposal to create their own sort of hybrid dark pool. So that's just a symbol of the shift towards opacity in the stock market.
So even the exchange is going to have, or has, a dark pool in and of its own.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, the exchange is the clearinghouse, and they have a dark pool too. It's scary.
Yeah. It's surprising, but it shows you, you know, how the market is changing. And you know, one of the reasons why these dark pools have become so popular is because the big investment firms have been running away from the public markets because they're worried that the high-frequency firms that can see their buy and sell orders, they can see the supply and demand, can use that information to front-run them. So to escape from that, they're going to the dark pool. So in a way, that the dark pools are a symptom of the disease that is infecting the exchanges right now.
And again, there's nothing illegal about this, is there?
No, there is not anything illegal about it, although there are suspicious activities that go on, and the SEC is looking into some of these activities. The SEC, as we've reported in the pages of the Wall Street Journal, is looking at whether the exchanges have provided benefits to these high-frequency trading firms that allow them to, you know, have an advantage over other regular investors. This is an ongoing probe. We don't know what they're going to find yet. So, another problem is that the regulators can't really surveil the market at all because they don't have the technology to track all of this trading. So, you know, if there was something going on, we we wouldn't even know it unless they just got lucky or there was a whistleblower or something.
Right, right, right. You got to wonder, I mean, do you think there's any inkling of whether even the SEC, the regulatory body, has been to some extent or any extent bought off by Wall Street itself, by the people it's supposedly regulating? Because it seems there are so many things that are so unfair to the average investor and so favorable to institutional investors.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think bought off is a strong word.
Okay. You may not be able to totally answer that in your position.
Yeah, you know, I think the regulators, in terms of the stock market and the, you know, a lot of the markets today, have just been completely left behind by the technology that's overtaken the market in the past 10 or 15 years. They haven't kept up with the sophistication, and that's allowed these firms to do things that the regulator doesn't understand. And I think we saw this with a lot of the derivatives that blew up in the financial crisis. These, you know, the credit default swaps and synthetic CDOs that just eviscerated the balance sheets of all these banks around the world. The regulators just were, you know, totally asleep at the switch. They couldn't understand it. And I think something very similar is going on in the stock market and other markets too, like the futures markets or options markets, where very sophisticated trading strategies are taking place. Exchanges are helping those strategies succeed. And the regulator is just completely in the dark about it.
You know what amazed me? I think it was the 60 Minutes expose on high-frequency traders that it amazed me, is that literally these firms, these HFT firms, the speed is so important to them that at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, it makes a difference whether you're a few blocks away or you're right next door to the exchange in terms of how fast you can execute these trades. And it blows my mind that people actually think they're going to outwit that system.
Yeah. Well, you know, that kind of tells you where we're at right now. And that is the game, being in front of another firm by microseconds. Which is a millionth of a second. So these firms are fighting to beat each other by microseconds. In my book, Dark Pools, I tell the story of a company called Spread Networks that built a fiber optic cable between Chicago and New York. It cost them $300 million to build this cable. The cable allowed firms to gain a 3-millisecond advantage over firms using the current system. And that's 3,000th of a second.
And they spent $300 million to do that. And it was probably a good investment, right?
And they believed that there was going to be demand for the cable. Unfortunately, for this company, innovation is moving so fast that other firms realized that they could use microwave signals to send orders between Chicago and New York faster than this cable. So the demand wasn't as robust as they'd hoped, because innovation is moving so quickly and everybody is trying to get in front of everybody else so ardently that as soon as you build something, it's already out of date. So it's just an endless cycle of innovation. The question is, what advantage does that bring to regular investors? And it's really hard to argue, you know, that it's bringing any advantage. You know, you could see why, you know, when they... It used to take an average of 20 or 30 seconds to get an order executed on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. You know, now it's less than a second. You can see how that's an advantage. That helps the market become more efficient. But when you're talking about an order being executed 10 microseconds faster, you really start to wonder whether the efficiency that we're gaining has any impact or improvement, and if it actually could be detrimental to the market, if that's what the race is now. And it is where the race is now.
Just out of curiosity, is there any access to either high-frequency trading or dark pools, because they both seem very beneficial to the people that run them and the investors in them, that a middle-class day-to-day investor can get involved? For example, can I buy a share of a mutual fund that runs a dark pool and a high-frequency trading firm and make some of their money? Now, granted, I know they're going to pay the management and the board of directors a lot more than me, but at least I could be part of the whole thing.
You know, I mean, one of these days we're going to see a mutual fund that's, you know, a high-frequency trading firm. I think the closest that investors can get now is hedge funds. And there are plenty of hedge funds that have high-frequency trading operations. You know, one of the biggest is Citadel Investment Group. They have a very successful high-frequency trading firm that is called Tactical Trading. And in 2008, it made $1 billion. So, you know, the average investor, though, not really. It's, you know, this is still something that's, you know, there for the wealthy and the insiders on Wall Street.
Right, right. It's way out of their league. Let's just kind of back up. Maybe we should have started the interview with this, but let's talk about quants for a minute. Your book is entitled The Quants, and you have probably seen, I was fascinated by it, the movie Margin Call, right?
Yeah, I did see that. It was a good movie.
Yeah, it was a great movie. And you know what totally impacted me about that movie is, remember the scene where the Peter Sullivan character gets called in at 3 in the morning, you know, and then the head of the firm has flown in from Europe or something and wants to
right.
see him. And he says, and you know, the Peter Sullivan character is like 26 years old and the head
he's
of the
a quant.
Firm. He's a quant. Yeah. And the head of the firm says, hey, kid across the table, you know, what's your background? What's your degree? And he says something like, you know, I went to MIT. And my thesis, my PhD dissertation was on the way rocket propulsion impacts resistance or some crazy thing like that, right?
Yeah.
And the head of the firm says, so basically, you're a rocket scientist. And he says, and he says, yeah, but there's more money on Wall Street. So,
yep. That says it all.
That's really what these quants are. They're just mathematical geniuses. And they would normally be, I think that's kind of like, you know, not to go too far afield, but it's kind of a sad statement in a way for, you know, American enterprise that these people aren't in the sciences. They're just in the moving money game. Your thoughts?
Yeah. That's the story I tell in the quants is how Wall Street starting in, I go all the way back to the early 60s, became increasingly mathematical. And, you know, these guys were able to figure out inefficiencies and prices between all these different asset classes and design arbitrage strategies. They're also frequently good computer programmers, so that would help them crunch the numbers. And it just got bigger and bigger and, you know, basically was, you know, by the early 2000s running Wall Street. You know, I think that it was the machine behind, you know, everything. And then it blew up. It was kind of a quant bubble in all sorts of different ways. And I try to show that in the book is, you know, how there were stock trading strategies that blew up in 2007. These derivatives that were behind the big asset bubble and mortgage industry blew up. And all of these things were designed by these mathematicians who have taken over Wall Street. You know, a lot of them are well-intentioned. But yeah, it was the money. I mean, you know, it's the old story of, you know, what drives Wall Street. It's greed and
sure,
fear.
Sure. There was that, what was the name of that firm? Forgive me. You know, I'm not a Wall Street guy, so this is not top of mind to me. But there was that firm about 12 years ago that blew up that their whole thing was, they said,
it's got to be long-term capital management.
Yes, yeah, long-term capital management. Thank you. And their basic stance was, we have figured out the markets. We know how to mathematically beat the market, and we're sure of it. And, you know, then, of course, they lost a bunch of money, and the whole thing blew up.
But yeah.
Any background on long-term capital management?
Yeah, well, that definitely was a quant-driven firm. Their strategies were entirely based on these mathematical arbitrages that they had figured out. They had a couple Nobel Prize-winning economists on their staff. So I think that they're, you know, like you say, they thought they'd figured it out. And this is one of the big temptations of the quant mentality is that you think you've managed risk so much that you can leverage up more. So long-term capital believed that it had hedged out all of the possibilities, all the negative events that could go on. And, you know, that's a big part of these quant strategies is hedging out a negative event. And if you have all the negatives under control, then you can take more leverage. So they ended up becoming leveraged something like 100 to 1 at one point. And it even rose to something like infinity when they were losing all their money. So it's hubris, you know. I mean, it's a classic tale of hubris. And I think it just long-term wasn't a warning, ironically, to Wall Street that there's something dangerous in the strategy. I think Wall Street looked at it and said, huh, well, that was a good idea. We can just do it better.
What advice would you have for the average investor? That's the vast majority of the world out there in terms of numbers. It may not be in terms of dollars, but or it may still be actually in terms of dollars just because there are so many of them. But, you know, what should they do? I mean, should they just buy an index fund and follow the random walk advice or not be on Wall Street at all and buy some rental properties? What should they do?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I mean, everybody wants to know now with interest rates so low, fixed income seems like a terrible place to be, but the market seems really risky. And I think it's probably riskier than people realize, given, you know, how everything running it now is, you know, these computers that are susceptible to systemic events. But there have been so many studies showing that active investing is a huge waste of time. You pay more fees. These fund managers are often hugging the index as much as they can because they're just trying to beat it just a little bit. So why not just put your money in a low fee index fund and hope for the best?
Well, and that was really the foundation of a huge company, Vanguard. You know,
Vanguard, right?
I mean, their whole thing was just buy the index and call it a day, and you know, just wait.
Yeah, I that seems like a pretty smart strategy to me, and especially that active managers tend to trade too much. And given how, you know, what I've seen with these high frequency firms, you know, for a while, yeah, the market became more efficient and it became cheaper to trade. But I think they're just getting their clocks clean these days. So the more you trade, the more money you're going to lose.
I love how in the Dark Pools book you talk about, and you probably kind of branded this term, AI bandits, artificial mm-hmm. intelligence bandits, and the threat to the global financial system. I mean, we've talked today a bit about, you know, individual investors, but what is the threat to the overall system, the systemic risk mm-hmm. here? Won't they just trade against each other and the software will become better, the algorithms will become better, and the elites and the insiders will make all the money, and basically the market will eventually go back to, I mean, really, that's the way the stock market was in the old days. You know, the little guy didn't access the stock market very much, and Merrill Lynch was really one of the big promoters that brought it into the, you know, more public sphere. Maybe it'll just go back to the elites and they'll just be trading against each other.
Yeah, I don't think they would like that very much because they like to feed off the little guy.
I'm glad you admit
like
that.
The fish food, you know, that it feeds the sharks in the pool. But in terms of the systemic threat that I'm talking about, you know, that partly comes from my experience covering the flash crash for the Wall Street Journal. I really got to see how the system is fragile. It's highly complex and it's very fragile, you know, kind of like, you know, the space shuttle is an example. It's a tiny thing went wrong with the space shuttle Challenger in an O-ring and the whole thing blew up. And there's theories that say that if, you know, the more complex a system is, the more vulnerable it is to some kind of systemic event like that, that can lead to a huge sort of black swan like event. The flash crash is like that. It was a 10% decline in the U.S. stock market in a matter of minutes. It did bounce back, but, you know, we don't know if it happens again, if it could be 20%, if it will bounce back. There's also concerns that because these firms are trading many different asset classes at a single time, like futures and options and currencies, that if you get a big move in one, it can spill over to another asset class, and they call that the splash crash. Some people much smarter than me have come up with this. These experts in artificial intelligence and risk management, and you know, these are concerns that people need to be aware of. It's not just fear mongering. You know, people say that, you know, I'm trying to scare people and that's going to hurt them because they're going to be afraid of the market, you know, but I'm trying to draw attention to this problem that we have because the market has shifted to being very computer driven, and these computers are, they're trading so quickly that they can do things so rapidly. They can pull out of the market in the blink of an eye. And that's what happens is these strategies, they don't really like it when the market becomes too chaotic. They're risking too much money, so they just pull out. And that's what we saw on May 6, 2010. The flash crash.
You're right. They'll just yank the money out and cause a sudden dive in prices. Yeah, that's
right.
It's scary when you don't, like a lot of people have talked about the psychology of markets and trying to predict how other investors will think and act and go counter to their trends and so forth. But it's just very hard to do that, if not completely impossible, when you've got all of these different motivations and big institutional players. It's just a whole different world. It's not very logical in a lot of ways, is it?
Right. Yeah. Or maybe it's becoming too logical.
One or the other. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of a conundrum.
I mean, I think that there's going to always be room for the really smart investment manager who, you know, like Warren Buffett. I used to cover Berkshire Hathaway for the Journal, and I got to know Buffett and became very impressed with his discipline and his ability to pick stocks. But there's just no question that more and more computer trading is going on. And at the end of my book, Dark Pools, in the final chapter, I write about a small hedge fund in New York City called Rebellion Research. And this is run by a group of really young, like 20-something guys who have designed an artificial intelligence trading system that buys and sells stocks for the long term, kind of, and I call it like a digital Warren Buffett. So in a way, I felt like, you know, this is, we know that the computers are running the second by second or microsecond by microsecond trading of stocks, but there's always going to be a role for the fund manager who can, you know, really dig into the balance sheet and figure out the long term investment. But these guys have created a computer that can do that. And it's been very successful, actually, over the past 4 or 5 years. So who knows, in 10 years from now, is your fund manager going to be a computer? It's possible.
Very interesting stuff. Well, besides Dark Pools, which just came out, I guess, last month, huh?
That's right.
That's Dark Pools, High Speed Traders, AI Bandits,